The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Don't worry about my eyesight, folks. I have more vision than the President of the United States.
Well, thank you very much for coming. It's really an honor to be on stage with you. Thanks to all of you in the audience for showing up, and thanks to the Free Library for inviting me. I thought for my first question I'd start at the beginning. This is a wonderful book.
Thank you.
Fascinating, revelatory. I learned a great deal from it. In the beginning, you talk about your childhood. And the thing that struck me about that is how different an upbringing you had than the usual Washington insider. And when you came to Washington, it was, in fact, as something of an outsider. And I was wondering what you thought, what kind of an impact that had on your career.
I credit my upbringing in the wholesome state of Nebraska and my public education at the public schools of Lincoln, Nebraska, and the University of Nebraska, and its law school, with much of my success. And I believe one of the lines, don't remember whether it's in the beginning or the end, is that having lived in Nebraska, Washington, Boston, New York, I thought the air, the water, and the politics were all cleaner in Nebraska.
One of the things that comes through very clearly in the book is the incredibly close relationship that you had with JFK, intellectually close, close in terms of your views of policy, but also a very close personal relationship. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit about how a working relationship turns into a personal relationship, if there are any particular moments where you felt that a friendship was developing or that it was the relationship was moving beyond a professional one.
Let me first emphasize that although we were certainly friends, I was not part of his social circle and had no wish to be a drinking buddy. I wished to be his advisor on policy and politics. But when I first met JFK, on the surface we had nothing in common. Big difference in religion, in region, in wealth, in military experience, in education. But none of those really mattered. What really mattered was the fact that we were both committed to public service, both interested in public policy, and both trained by our parents to do everything we could to make this a better country and a better world. So in 1956, as I describe in the book, almost by accident, he became overnight a national figure as a result of the Democratic Convention of 1956. He went off on a European vacation, probably relieved that he was not going to be vice president on a losing Democratic ticket. It was his concession in that race, I think, that won the hearts of Americans. When he came back from the vacation, I took over to his house a briefcase full of the dozens, maybe hundreds of invitations that had flowed in from all over the country during that time as a result of that convention appearance. And that night on his dining room table, we worked out a sort of a tentative schedule, priority invitations, some from Democratic Party organizations, some from civic organizations, many of them from educational institutions. And after we had that worked out, he looked at me and said seven fateful words. you might as well come with me. For the next 4 years, we traveled the 50 states together. Until the very end of those 4 years, it was just JFK and me. And believe me, when you travel that much with one other person and have almost all your meals with him and talk on every plane trip and automobile trip and work together testing the waters for the presidency, not only did it teach me what I could write that he would like and what he could successfully use, taught him a little bit about depending on me, and that is what changed the relationship from the initial formal professional relationship. We did not know each other or much about each other at the beginning, into a very close friendship.
One of the most interesting things in this book, I thought, was your reflections on the art of speechwriting. And you emphasize how important it is for a speechwriter to tailor a speech to the principal. So that, of course, you know, the policy must be determined in part by the principal. And even for different people, you'll have to use different phrases and different idioms. And the conclusion that I drew from that was that for a truly great speech, you need not only a great speechwriter, but also a great leader. And I was wondering from that perspective.
Very well said. You ought to be a speechwriter.
I was wondering from that perspective if you have any views you'd like to share on our current political situation, what you think of, well, the speeches of not just our current leaders, but also perhaps the candidates.
It's too bad Pennsylvania's already voted. I think that of the two remaining candidates for the Democratic nomination, which is the one I've paid the closest attention to, one of them is a great speaker who has often reminded me of JFK. The other one is not bad reading a text, but nothing like her opponent or like JFK. There are many, many similarities. Young senator facing a major demographic obstacle to being an easy choice for the presidency, had spent time traveling or living abroad. In JFK's case, he was the son of an ambassador. A commitment to peace, in the case of both of them, but the ability to inspire listeners, whether large or small audiences, is so important in the presidency itself. Whether you're talking to foreigners on the steps of Berlin City Hall, or whether you're talking to the United Nations General Assembly, or whether you're talking to a joint session of Congress, that ability to reach all kinds of audiences, to inspire them, to mobilize them, to arouse them, to support whatever you're urging, is a crucial ingredient, as Kennedy found in the presidency, and as I believe Obama will as well.
When I was reading the book, I actually had very similar thoughts. The parallels between Kennedy and Obama certainly came to mind when I was reading your discussion of the analysis that was done of what effect Kennedy's Catholicism would have on different constituencies in different states, and also your description of his speech about religion. It put me in mind of a speech Obama delivered here at the National Constitution Center about race. And yet, with all of that, I also felt a bit of sadness because it seemed to me that the political climate or the media climate nowadays is not so receptive to the transmission of complicated ideas to the public. And I was wondering if this is also your view. I feel that there's been a great dumbing down of our public discourse, and that the media tends to focus on irrelevant issues. And I'm wondering whether you think that that has actually gotten noticeably worse in our lifetimes.
You just gave most of my answer. I think that, first of all, I should make it very clear that Kennedy's speech to the Houston Protestant Ministers Association, as powerful as I believed it to be, did not end the religious issue. It was still the number one reason that he lost as many votes as he did, according to all the exit polls and surveys. So I think Senator Obama is going to face the fact that his speech here in Philadelphia on race, a courageous, comprehensive speech, unlike any I know it's ever been delivered, though some should have delivered it long ago, it's not going to end the problem. There is still enormous amounts of subterranean racism out there, and I hear about it all the time. And friends of mine who go out and knock on doors or man the telephone banks for Obama encounter it all the time. Terrible things that some people say. But your use of the word irrelevant is very important. The truth of the matter is, and maybe this is one of the reasons why JFK assigned me, a Unitarian from Nebraska, to be the specialist on the religious issue in 1960 and the years leading up to it. The truth of the matter is, there were some justifiable concerns for the potential role of the Catholic hierarchy if that worried people in the event that the United States elected a Catholic president. The Catholics weighed in on many public policy issues. That was relevant. But what is the possible relevance of the color of a man's skin? None whatsoever. And yet, I think that demographic challenge is going to be out there until the election is over. Only when people become accustomed to the idea of a black president, in much the same way they became accustomed to the idea of a Catholic president who clearly was not permitting his religious obligations to take priority over his constitutional obligations, I think that pretty well dispelled the religious issue, and I hope a similar process after Obama has been in office for a while will dispel the racial prejudices.
One more question on current events. You mentioned in the book that after the election of 2000 and the Florida recount, you were asked how JFK had managed to unify the country after a tightly contested election. And you responded, I think, that he appointed Republicans to important positions. George W. Bush perhaps took that advice too literally. But
in what way?
By appointing Republicans to important positions. But I was wondering if you had any thoughts on how that experience might suggest ways to unify the Democratic Party after the primary.
I do not think the so-called dream ticket will come about no matter who wins the nomination. But I have privately said, and as long as we're being very confidential here, I have privately said I think that when time comes for Obama to pick a running mate, and that time doesn't come until the last moment when he's certain he has the presidential nomination and can survey the situation, where is he weak, where does he need to be shored up, what groups within the party, what groups or regions within the country, all of those require the leading candidate to wait until he has the nomination before he makes a decision Up till then, there are all those governors and senators who think they might be named. In any event, my thought has been, when that time comes, he ought to consider picking a Republican or a woman.
I read an article recently recently
asking for names out there? I really don't want to make news on this. I am not part of the Obama inner circle. I don't speak for him. I don't even, except on very, very rare occasion, speak to him. But I'm from Nebraska, and we have a Republican Senator, Chuck Hagel, who's a great internationalist. I'm from the Midwest, and just below Nebraska, there's a governor of Kansas who is the daughter of a friend of mine who was very active in Ohio politics a couple generations ago, and everything I hear about her is that she knows how, winning a state like Kansas, to reach out to Republicans, independents, and you can't win in Kansas just with Democratic votes. So those are two possibilities.
Thank you. I read an article recently that made the point that historically, America has been very lucky in the leaders that we've had at times of crisis, starting with George Washington, Lincoln, FDR, and JFK. And I was wondering what qualities you think we should focus on in order to maximize our chance of getting lucky next time. What are the qualities that you think make a president great?
Not his smile and hairdo on television. Judgment. The single most important quality for success in the White House is judgment. The president, day after day, maybe a dozen times a day, must make decisions. To decide is to choose. To choose a team, that's the single most important judgment he makes right at the start. To choose a policy, a program, to choose the timing of when he makes a particular move, to choose his allies, unless you're going to follow in the current administration's course and ignore allies. So all of those choices require superb judgment. And I suppose the average voter is not always able to tell. But take a look at a candidate and even in the campaign. Believe me, to run a national campaign requires a huge organization and the selection of very able people who will not be fighting and feuding and splitting into factions. We've seen quite a contrast in the two candidates this year on that front.
As a follow-up question to that, one of the things that will get you good decisions is a good president. Another thing to focus on, I think, is the structure within which decision-making takes place. So I was wondering if you could comment on the context in which JFK made his most important decisions, what the procedure was, how open he was to dissenting views, whether he wanted to hear all sides of an issue, and how you think that contributed to his success.
First of all, you could have put in a plug for my first little book called Decision Making in the White House. I'm sure it's in the library. But I think that if I can take a little time on just one group of decisions, the most important group of decisions any president ever made, was Kennedy in the Cuban Missile Crisis, when the very survival of the country, maybe the planet, was at stake. He called me in on the morning of October 16th, 1962, told me that they had discovered Soviet nuclear missiles in Cuba, and that he was calling a meeting not a few months later, after he had cleared the brush on his ranch, but immediately. He was calling a meeting He was calling a meeting that morning. And he was not calling a meeting of the National Security Council, interestingly enough. It was a formal apparatus provided by statute. But for one thing, it required a large group whose jobs were specified who would meet with him. He didn't want the statute to tell him whom to meet with on such a crucial decision. And he didn't want them in Washington. Everybody wants to attend a National Security Council meeting. It's very high status. So every statutory member feels he has to bring an assistant or a deputy with him. Sometimes the deputy needs to bring an assistant with himself. And the meeting becomes so large that, A, it's too unwieldy to make the kind of crisp, clear decision JFK liked to make, and B, it's too large to keep a secret. And JFK did not want the Russians to know that we knew what they had done, because that might invite them to take some kind of preemptive action. And once that group, not the National Security Council, but those a dozen or so of us whose judgment he respected and whose recommendations he thought would be worthwhile, not because any of us had had any experience in a nuclear confrontation. There had never been a nuclear confrontation. But once that group was assembled, he asked that we provide him with every option he had and the pros and cons of every option. He hadn't heard about one route, such as the invasion of Iraq, and refused to consider all others. No, he wanted to hear about all possibilities: military options, diplomatic options, military-diplomatic combinations. Even the option of doing nothing ought to be at least weighed for its pros and its cons. The answer evolved during that week, and I don't think we have enough time for me to go through step by step, also because it's in the book. But then the question came, should he communicate with the Soviets? Conventional wisdom always said no, just as it does today. We don't communicate with the Iranians. We don't communicate with the Syrians or Hamas, much less the Iraqis. But Kennedy felt that communication was important, and the final stage of those communications, in which I was deeply involved, evolved into a form of negotiation. You weren't supposed to negotiate with your adversary either, but Kennedy did. So that combination of selecting a team, not as provided by statute, but based upon the best recommendations that he wanted, of asking for every option and the pros and cons of those options, of being willing to communicate with the adversary, ultimately negotiating with the adversary, and then selecting the right time for those communications and negotiations, were all ingredients of the Kennedy decision-making process. And I should have added in the middle there, briefing his allies, keeping them informed. He knew that in a dangerous world, the United States cannot go it alone. And he also went to the United Nations. He believed in international organizations. He believed in international law. And he ultimately included in the answer, the response that was formulated, going to the Organization of American States, which is like a regional little UN, and getting the Organization of American States to join us in the blockade, or quarantine as we called it, partly for legal reasons. And thereby it became a regional security arrangement which was authorized by the UN Charter.
The account of the Cuban Missile Crisis is probably the most gripping moment in the book. The book also has some sad moments. And one of the sad ones, I thought, was your description of meeting with a foreign relations group in Rome and having them say to you, tell us about the good America when Kennedy was president.
Not so long
ago. For those
ago.
who haven't read the book, I'd like you to share your response.
You think I've memorized my book? This was I remember all too well. It was roughly 5 years ago this fall, and the mayor of Rome had invited me and some others to participate in a special conference on the 40th anniversary of Kennedy's death. And I was invited by a side group. They weren't part of the official program. Would I please come and speak to this group? And I said, yes. When I got there, I said, what do you want me to talk about? And the chairman said, tell us about the good America when Kennedy was in the White House. And I said, it's still a good America. One aberrational election does not change the goodness and the generosity of the American people. We are still people who want peace. We are still people who believe in a world of law. And I probably went from there to talking more about Kennedy than I did about Bush.
What advice would you give a young person who's maybe entering college or graduating from college, who wants to go out and make the world a better place? It seems to me that a number of the avenues that people might have taken in the past are not appealing in the same ways. I mean, I think that the legal profession has changed, for instance. Politics has changed. Journalism has changed. What would you say to a young person now who wants to go out and try to make the world a better place?
Very important question. I would say several things. Number one, after you graduate from college or at any time in life, join the Peace Corps. It's still one of John Kennedy's greatest creations and inventions. My daughter was in the Peace Corps, and when she left the little village in Morocco where she had provided medical advice for maternal and child care, people in that village cried. She was a face of America, totally different from the face they had seen the bombers flying overhead and the on television, the military might. So the Peace Corps is a way to help. Second, I would say, join a political campaign. Join the campaign of a candidate, whether at the national level or at the local level, who has principles that you share. Work in that campaign. I don't care whether it's whether you start out stuffing envelopes or knocking on doors, but talent rises in politics sometimes because there's not much there. And when you rise to a position, as I was lucky enough to, politics hasn't changed quite as much as you said in your question. Yes, there's meanness, there's name-calling. There's been meanness and name-calling in politics all the way back to the most vicious campaign of them all between Jefferson and Adams in 1800. So politics, for all its limitations, and it has many, is still a path to involvement in deciding the future of this country and its role in the world. So I just think there are many opportunities for someone who wants to make this this country a better place.
One last question for me before we go to the audience. What do you want people to learn from this book?
Well, I don't know whether the New York Times will put it on the how-to section or not, but it's so happens I do have a memo in there about how to write a speech or how to write a speech for a president. And I do have a memo, that is a combination of several memos that I wrote over the decades after I left the White House to a lot of would-be presidents on how to run for president. So if you're interested in running, take a look. But in addition to the how-to specifics, I hope that people will realize that this is not only a good country, it's a great country. As I mentioned, my father was born in a sod house. Nobody in Philadelphia has ever heard of a sod house, but a house made out of dirt out there on the prairie to two parents from Denmark who didn't speak a word of English when they were brave enough to leave a nice little island, hazard the trip across the Atlantic, then a trip across half the country, under Abraham Lincoln's homestead law, stake out some land, and fight the terrible winters, the summer heat, grasshoppers, dust storms, and all the rest. And their son, my father, under what is one of the more fascinating stories of the book, ultimately ended up the Attorney General of Nebraska. And when he ran for re-election, my mother, the daughter of Jewish immigrants who also were penniless when they arrived, my mother suggested a pretty good campaign slogan. I point out in the book, from sod house to state house. My deepest regret was that he did not live to see me move into an office a few doors from the president so that he could have said, from sod house to state house to White House in one generation. It's still a great country.
Thank you very much. That was wonderful. We'll take some questions from the audience now. We've got a microphone that will move around, so please wait till you get the microphone before you ask a question.
You'll have to call hands. I can't see hands.
Okay.
Right in front of you, Mr. Sorensen. Very, very deeply honored to be here with you today. I have two questions, one current, one past. The current, is the United States, especially the Bible Belt, ready for a man of color to become president of the United States? The past question is, I've always wanted to meet the man whose lips were next to the ear of John F. Kennedy. How close were we to having the biggest crisis or war with Russia during the Cuban crisis?
An answer to the first question, of course, we're ready. Unfortunately, your wording is the same wording used by good man. Former President Harry Truman, is the country ready for a Catholic president, he said in 1960. And Senator Kennedy, he went on to say, are you sure you're ready? And as I flew back across the country from California, where I'd already arrived to get ready for the convention, back to Cape Cod, where JFK was resting before the convention, because of the Truman speech, he called me and said, come back, because believe it or not, in those days of equal time, there he was being given a free half hour or whatever it was on national television 1 week before the convention. Truman did us a great favor. But searching and searching for material, I received a wire from a very distinguished historian who had a quotation from Abraham Lincoln, which fit perfectly, and it became the ending of that speech. I know there is a Lord, and I know his hand is in it. If he, said Lincoln, if he has a place for me, I believe that I am ready. Perfect quotation. My trouble is, no Lincoln historian could ever find what Lincoln had said it. So So as I indicated, inasmuch as this country desperately needs new and well-equipped leadership on the key quality of judgment, the color of the man's skin is not in the slightest relevant, and the American people, I think, have enough wisdom in such a critical time to end. I happen to believe, it's a critical time because we're a nation under siege. Islamic terrorism is going to be a factor for a long time to come. But the election of a man of color is going to change the attitude of the rest of the world toward this country the day he walks into the White House. Now, in terms of number two, we came very close. Kennedy won that presidential, first of all, he won the nomination, which was an alphabetical roll call. He got a majority when the roll call got to Wyoming, the last state called. He won the election in the fall by a comfortable electoral vote majority, but the electoral vote magnifies often, because it's on a winner-take-all basis, the popular vote, and the popular vote was the narrowest margin, at least in the 20th century, maybe the 20th and 19th, until that time. Something like 0.25% of the popular vote. So Richard Nixon, who in 1962, some of you old enough to remember will recall that he imploded while he was running for governor of California, had a very weird press conference. He came very, very close to being President of the United States during that Cuban Missile Crisis, and I haven't the slightest doubt he would have gone in the opposite direction from Kennedy, because the Joint Chiefs of Staff were urging Kennedy to go in the opposite direction. And had we taken their advice, had Kennedy taken their advice and attacked the missile sites, followed up, as they recommended, with an invasion, we now know, we knew a few years after the crisis, we didn't know then, but we now know that the Russian troops on the island were equipped with tactical nuclear weapons and the authority to use them in the event of an attack. And had they used tactical nuclear weapons under the so-called rules of engagement during that mad era, we would have used at least tactical nuclear weapons in responding. And once both parties are on that ladder of escalation, they go up pretty quickly to strategic nuclear weapons, and exchange results in neither country being left. And radioactive fallout would be carried by wind and water to the far reaches of the earth until only a nuclear desert remains. So we were fortunate that we had, as President of the United States, a man who did not submit to the pressure from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, or even, I might add, the congressional leaders. When he assembled them, they said, oh, this is too weak, a quarantine, a blockade. You got to hit them hard. Everybody always wants to hit them hard, forgetting that the other side can hit just as hard or harder. So we came very close, and I think after you read the book, you might conclude that perhaps the most risky step of all was the President of the United States asking a 34-year-old kid from Nebraska who had never had any international experience to draft that final letter to Khrushchev. That was me.
in the second row here?
I'm going to try and get some civil water here.
Oh, sorry. Hello. To what extent do you think communications technology in the 21st century, internet, blogosphere, 24/7 news, has changed, for better or worse, political campaigning as compared to, let's say, the 60s the era that you were talking about.
It's interesting. I thought you were going to end that with a different question, and I'll answer the question I thought you were going to ask. In terms of the question you actually asked, I'm not convinced that the 24-hour, 7 news cycle and all of the bloggers weighing in on every issue, so on, I'm not convinced that is a step toward sounder election choices. It seems to have added to both the intensity and the endurance of every scandal, every stumble, of which there are bound to be some in almost every election cycle. So let me move to the question I thought you were going to ask is, how has it affected decision-making at the highest level? That first morning of October 16 when we met in the cabinet room, everybody assumed that the swiftest, neatest, best way to get rid of the Soviet nuclear missiles in Cuba was what the Air Force called a surgical airstrike. Sounded great. Swoop down, pinpoint bombing, fly away, status quo ante. Not at all. Both the President and I had the bad habit of asking a lot of questions. Partly it's my Unitarian background. Turned out that the Air Force was not willing to send those planes there unless the Soviet surface-to-air missiles were first bombed out of existence. And then they thought the Cuban bomber airfields ought to be bombed, otherwise they might send a plane over to Florida, bomb Florida while we're doing that. And then they had other bombing sites, and as I mentioned before, they felt there'd be so much bombing on the length and breadth of Cuba that we'd have to follow up with an invasion to try to handle the chaos. That was what we first thought was the right answer. Interestingly enough, 6-7 days later, when Kennedy convened the congressional leaders, they also thought that was a much better answer. But because we did not have as many leaks as are inevitable now, because we were able to keep confidential the project we were working on, the President wanted everybody to keep to their regular schedules, even campaign commitments. He said he did not want limousines lined up in front of the White House causing everybody to speculate that there must be some crisis meeting going on. Because we had as much time as we did to formulate the answer was a much more prudent answer and a much more successful answer, and Kennedy obtained the withdrawal of those missiles without firing a shot. Now, all the technology, modern technology to which you referred, would probably make it possible for a current Kennedy to go on national television and say, now, ladies and gentlemen, your television sets are now equipped. If you believe that we should bomb the missile sites, push the button twice. If you believe we should have a quarantine, push it 3 times. I don't want decisions made that way.
Over here.
For years, there's been speculation, at least in the popular mind, that if President Kennedy had not died, the course of American involvement in Vietnam would have been very different. Do you think that's true?
Yes, that is true. Because, number one, he was too smart to get politically involved and to become militarily involved on a land war in Asia. He had given a speech when he was United States Senator, when Eisenhower was suggesting we might replace the French in Indochina. And he also made a very famous speech opposing French continued domination in Algeria, which earned him a few enemies, because he realized that a country that suffered decades, if not centuries, of colonialism wanted to be rid of its occupants, foreign occupation forces, and there's no way to win such a war militarily. Politically, diplomatically, yes. And he made statements to that effect. I'll bet there's nobody in this room who remembers when national news went from 15 minutes to 30 minutes on television, and when Walter Cronkite went from 15 to 30 minutes, he invited the President of the United States to appear on his show. And Walter and I have actually talked about this later. And Kennedy said, when asked about the war in Vietnam, it's their war to win or lose, not ours. If they suggest that they don't want us there, we'll start leaving on the next boat. And so he announced, and I think it was, he was killed November 22nd, I think it was November 1st, that he and Secretary McNamara announced that of the 17, it was by then up to 17,000 military advisors and instructors that we had sent to Vietnam. He was going to have, he said, our main objective now is to get them out, and we're going to have at least 1,000 of those 17,000 out by the end of this year. Every mission he sent to Vietnam as president came back saying, instructors and advisors that Eisenhower put in, that's not enough. You've got to send combat troop divisions to South Vietnam, and you've got to bomb North Vietnam. Kennedy listened. He heard them, but he never did either one, and I don't believe he ever would have done either one. And he learned in Cuba. He learned in Berlin. He learned in Congo that military answers don't work. You need diplomacy. You need political communications.
One last question here in the third row.
If you were going to advise President Barack Obama how to end the war in Iraq, what would you say? What would your advice be?
Bring them home. I'm fully aware of the fact that when American troops pull out of Iraq, there will be sectarian bloodshed and chaos. If American troops stay in Iraq, there will be sectarian bloodshed and chaos. Americans are part of the problem there. We opened up a Pandora's box. I can't tell you how many Iraqis have practically cried telling me that Shia and Sunni often intermarried, often lived in the same neighborhood, often worked together, but it was only the American invasion and occupation and the distribution of arms that accompanied that has set off these terrible waves of bloodshed. So I don't say it will be a peaceful, democratic heaven if the Americans leave, but at least there won't be. At least if they continue their sectarian civil wars, they won't be killing Americans while they do it.
Thank you very much. Thank you for a wonderful evening.
Oh, thank you. Oh, nice. Thank you. Very good. I'll just add one word why this is a special night for me. This month begins my ninth decade on this planet, and I have promised to be ready on day one.
Thank you, everybody, for joining us with Mr. Sorensen. Dinner will be served upstairs.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.